Bring the world closer with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe.
Whoa.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
Welcome to the documentary in the studio from the BBC World Service, the programme that explores the creative process. I'm Sue Mitchell, and in this programme, I'll be finding out what it's like as a filmmaker to cover the issue of homelessness in one of the wealthiest parts of the world. How do people find new ways of documenting a problem that only seems to be getting worse? It's a question that was on my mind when I started recording a 10-part series for the BBC in the American state of California. There are more homeless people in California than anywhere else in America. Around 200,000 people, many of them living in tents, cars, or on the streets. And that series I mentioned is called Intrigue, Million Dollar Lover. Recording it took me to some of the most deprived wastelands imaginable. And it also made me curious about how others are covering what's happening here. My recordings gave glimpses of the struggles the homeless face, but these were set aside an intriguing love story. The filmmaker, Leonard Manzella, has attempted something altogether different for his documentary, Shoeshine Caddy. It's filmed in California, in the small university town of San Luis Obispo, which until fairly recently wasn't known for having much of a problem with homelessness.
And when I decided to do this film, I did not want to do a film on the homeless problem. I mean, there's been wonderful films done, and you know, I wanted to do it on a man, one person, and try to humanize it as much as I could. And that's
an interesting thing, because how do you choose one person out of a sea of homelessness?
What happened is, you know, I'd worked with them. I'm a social worker and a psychotherapist. This is my office. I have a practice. I'm kind of known for working with violent men, angry men, and I worked in the prisons, worked in juvenile halls, county jails, so I'm kind of doing that. And I was walking to work one day, and I saw this red apron way off in the distance in front of the courthouse. I went, "What's that?" As I got closer, I saw this handsome guy with his bowler hat and his vest and tie and his shoes. And I thought, who the hell is that? African-American guy, probably in his 60s.
For the last 30 years, Leonard's been working as a family therapist in San Luis Obispo. But in his early career, he was a well-known actor. And that man he spotted in the bright red apron is Adrian, who turned out to be polishing shoes for a living. I went to meet him to find out more.
My name is Adrian Spears, 60 years old, and I shine shoes.
What did you think when Leonard first suggested making the movie on you?
When he said that, I said, sure. Plus, I knew I was going to get some exposure or whatever. Because I like getting, you know, put it this way, you don't know a woman that likes to play dress up more than me. I love to get dressed up.
Adrian's been in and out of prison for most of his life. He's wrestled with addiction.
Last time I got in trouble, I went to prison and I was there for 6 years and 8 months. So I told myself, you better come up with something. You know, if I was to go back again on a felony, it would be a long time.
By day, he's impeccably turned out. And there's a steady stream of people waiting to have their shoes shined.
First ever shoe shine, they look fantastic.
He keeps his clothes in a storage unit and presses his shirts every morning. To look at him, you'd never guess that he had nowhere to live and was sleeping rough at night.
Like what I'm going to wear today, I knew I was going to wear this 2 days ago.
Yeah.
Like right now I got on some two-tone Stacy Adams. They're navy blue and tan.
They look really well polished.
Of course, they better be. And I got on some tan slacks and I got on a brown, like a white and dark brown pinstripe French cuff shirt, actually. Because I always wear cufflinks, that's my trademark. I don't wear regular shirts, that's a no-no. And then I have on a smock, and it says Shoeshine Caddy on it, on the back. And my name, Adrian, on the...
It's got your name on the front.
On the front.
And I just went by and just said, wow, that's cool. And I saw him, you know, for several days walking to work, and one day I stopped and had my shoe shine. So I was kind of curious, is he homeless, is he not? And they picked up that he was homeless, but he was very formal, very businesslike. He was friendly, but he wasn't like pushing the envelope or anything and looking for more. You know, he just shined my shoes, I paid him, and I left. I thought, God, what an interesting guy. And of course, curiosity, you know, you see a homeless guy, how would I do if I were on the street? And so I watched this guy for 3 or 4 months, and then I came by and I dropped him 5 pairs of shoes. I said, can you do these? Yeah, yeah, they'll be ready by 5. I came by 5, they were perfect, paid him. And I kept thinking, God, what a story that would be. But, you know, you do 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and well, yeah, there's no story. So probably another good 8, because I followed him for about a year before I decided to do a documentary. And he was a little down and out. I said, hey, what's going on, Adrian? He said, I've got some problems. I said, what? He said, well, I'm fighting for custody of my 3-year-old. Boing, that's it. There's my story.
Adrian's fight to get custody of his little girl gave the movie a structure and a purpose.
That's my daughter right there. Let me get a better picture. I'll get a real picture of her. She was, I was 57, and her mother was 27. It was the craziest thing. I was in a homeless shelter, and I met her, and the craziest thing, I've had a lot of younger ladies that they just want to be, they just think I'm a cool old guy, so they just want to be my friend, but nothing else. Just, that's it. So I thought that was what the case with her. And then she just caught me totally, completely off guard. And she said, are you going to give me something for my birthday? I said, what? We went and got a room. We was only together that one time and had my daughter. Had a DNA test in there. No, that's my daughter.
So I thought about it, and, you know, it was a big deal because I was in the film industry for years. That's how I earned a living. I lived in Europe for, you know, 18 years and was in the Italian film business. So I know that whole thing. But I was sure the camera loved him. You know, I knew that.
You can see why. Adrian's got style and charisma. When you stand with him for any length of time, he plays music and starts to sway.
Part of my, I guess, what's that word, my stick, would be I have a Bluetooth that I play old school music, you know, like Ella Fitzgerald, Dean Martin, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, Mel Torme, you know, the good old stuff. A lot of people like that.
Some people play golf on the weekends. I hunt con artists.
Unmissable podcasts from the BBC World Service.
Are County Mayo a great team blighted by mystical forces we can't comprehend?
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Telling stories from around the globe.
Every minute there's bombing and shelling. There is no safety. If I get any internet connection, I'll talk to you again.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary, Amazing Sports Stories, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
You're listening to The Documentary in the Studio from the BBC World Service.
And I'd approached him after that. I said, what would you think about me doing a documentary on you? And he went, wow, that might give me a lot of exposure. You know, that would be cool. Yeah, I'd like that. I said, well, you know, it means I'm going to have my head up your
exposure
ass.
Exposure can be a double-edged sword.
Yeah, yeah.
Exposing yourself to the world when you're living that kind of life.
My head up your butt for a long time. He said, that's okay. I want to know every move you make and I'm going to be with you.
It was interesting how you did it. You had no sort of on-screen presence yourself.
I'm really a fan of neorealism because I had a long film career in Italy and I love the French New Wave and I just love cinema verite. That was very influenced by a film called Umberto D by Vittorio De Sica. And it was just, he followed this homeless guy and it was a narrative, it was a feature, but I just loved the style. And what I wanted to do, I just tell the story by following the person and just see if this works. And so, but I got to tell you, it was long, tedious. You know, you would shoot, you know, hours and hours and hours for 90 seconds.
It's worth pointing out that Leonard hadn't even been thinking about making a movie before he met Adrian. He had to bring in some help and underwrite the whole venture himself. And he had to dig deep for the patience needed to track Adrian's journey through the welfare systems. To stand any chance of getting his daughter, Adrian needed to find somewhere to live and to convince the courts that he could care for Calypso, a girl he'd only really spoken to by phone.
She just turned 3 last month. So I'm presently doing a case plan. I ain't missed a beat and I did everything I'm supposed to do. So y'all wish me luck and pray for me. because I'm going to get my little girl. Her name's Calypso.
So I can go ahead and file a writ.
So what's she saying, that she's going to let them adopt my daughter?
Not yet. She set the hearing for that today.
Hello, my name is Adrian Spears. Do you guys take Section 8 vouchers?
Oh, it depends, you know. We'll be open to it.
That was really the thing, that the idea of the daughter was something that just kept him alive. It kept him, you know. And you think about all of us. All of us need something that is like the spark. And that was the spark, especially if you're homeless. You've got, you know, what you've got, you know. So this really kept him alive.
I love you, boo-boo. Are you still playing hide-and-go-seek? Daddy have to go to work, okay? Bye, baby. Bye, I love you.
I love you.
You love me back? That made my day. You know how you play music in the background? Well, remember the song, Isn't She Lovely? Isn't she lovely? I would love to play that when I get my little daughter.
I mean, Adrian was trying to get custody of Calypso.
Yeah.
You must have had your own reservations, having seen his life. Say that process had played out and he'd actually got nighttime visitation, or Calypso was coming here for extended stays or even to live. Would you have felt there was a moral responsibility on you at some point to say, to intervene in this and say to the authorities, well, you know, from what I've seen of his life, that maybe isn't a good world for a child to be in?
I felt like I can't get involved in that. I have to remain an observer. And I know the system. I'm a social worker. I've been to court, and I knew there was no way in hell he was getting the kid. There was no way. She'd been in foster care for 2 years with a solid, you know, there was no way any judge was going to give this child to a man who, born out of a one-night stand, and now he wants to do the right thing. So I kind of was confident about that. But if it had happened, I didn't even imagine it happening, because I talked with some high people up in social services, and they, Leonard, there's no way that this guy's getting it. And I was more worried about if he would go off the deep end when he realized it. So I kept planting seeds that, you know, that she's so lucky and maybe this is a good thing. And he would just get livid. He would sometimes really get upset. And I said, hey, I'm just, you know, just talking. So let's not talk about this anymore. Let's just go on. So I was always dancing that kind of. And then finally, all of what we talked with him, you know, about, that finally after, you know, that whole thing where he dropped out and he thought about it and came back and said, you know I need to leave her with those people. He came to that on his own after many seeds planting, after all these experiences, and then after realizing finally that, how could I really do this? But it took him a while to get there.
A lot of the movie was about your struggle to try and get your daughter and try and get full-time care of her, and obviously it ended up with you not being able to do that. Did you feel like really you were in a position to give her a good home? I mean, you were living
I didn't
home.
Feel that I was anyway. Well, because it was so frustrating trying to get a place, and even though I got a place, the place that I have where you have a roommate, they wasn't going to go for that anyway. They still wasn't going to let me have her. Yeah. I don't, you know. I do believe I'm going to see her again. Only thing I got to do is live long enough. Once she gets like 12 and 13 and all that, she's going to be asking about me and looking for me.
That staying alive bit is so much harder for the homeless. And one of the saddest moments in the movie comes from the realization that Daniel, who was with Adrian in opening scenes, has died. It hits home just how deadly the lack of affordable health care, and really any sort of care, can be.
I wanted to film more, you know, of him, because he was really interesting, and I wanted to film more. I knew where he slept, down by the old homeless shelter. I thought I'd follow him to work. You know, I had all this, your mind spinning all the time, what you're going to shoot, and didn't turn out.
Yeah. I thought it was all the more powerful for that, actually. I think it was really powerful that you only actually saw that bit of him.
That's right.
And that your focus never wavered from Adrian.
Yeah. And then at the beginning, when he's shining shoes at the very beginning, you see Daniel under, but you don't really notice him. But then it ties in. I went, oh, my God, I had to fish for this stuff to try to fit his presence. But he's there in the back. And so it was, I had the footage. I just had to go find it because there was such a ton of it, you know, and then to try to let the images tell the story.
It was sad in the film, I thought, that one of the homeless guys who was here with you.
Oh, and guess what?
Died.
His name is Daniel. It was hard, but...
How many times would you go and see him, say? Like, how would it work? Would you sort of phone him and say, I'm coming down to see you?
Yes. Or
how would it work? Yeah.
I would phone him and then, oh my God, he's lost so many phones. I don't know how many phones I bought. Because I had to get a hold of him. You know, going down and get him a new service. And, you know, so I had to do that. And I had to, you know, help him out, you know, sometimes. And just to try to make sure he was okay. And so it was, I really had to, you know, because I had an investment too at that point. I was just really trying to keep this guy afloat too. So we could, you know, finish this story and help him tell his story. And again, never knowing, you know, what the hell's going to come out of this. But we just kept going. But yeah, I was on it a lot.
I suppose given your training, you'd have been very aware of the sort of risks of his drinking and how he might easily slip back, because that's such a hard thing, especially when you're homeless, to sort of control. I know in the film he says he's been dry since October.
He'd been dry since I knew him. I met him, he was dry, and he talked about that being a big part of it. And then the night we were going to go, he hadn't seen his mom for like a long time, and he was going to go to his mom's house. That night, and we were scheduled to pick him up, and we were going to drive to Santa Barbara and to go do shoot his mom. He disappeared that night, and I'm ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing, and I'm like, oh God, I'm like livid. I'm just upset. I don't know what to do. So finally, you know, like 2 a.m, he calls me. He said, I'll meet me by the library. It's 6 a.m, and I'll be there, I promise. I said, boy, you can't do... Anyway, I showed up. I got out of the car. I was so angry. I said, sit down. I put the camera on him. And that's the shot of him talking about being homeless. I said, talk. I want to know what you did last night.
I wondered that about going to see the mom, because that must have been quite a difficult scene to be involved in for you to be there filming it. I mean, obviously, they hadn't had any contact, and you got a real sense from her that it was a very, very strained relationship full of lots of unresolved and probably unspoken issues.
Yeah.
What was that like to sort of sit in on that reunion?
I was just so set up with the logistics of shooting. I had no idea what was going to come out. I just had to trust that she said it was okay. He said it was okay, and the Gail was going to be there, and I just really set the cameras up and just went, okay, I hope something happens. And I just had to fish through it. But I didn't, it was easy for me. And you know, I've also, you know, been around cameras and film and people, and I just trust they're going to do what they're going to do. You know, and I had no expectations. I started out with really no expectations. I just had to expect whatever's going to come.
I think that's probably the right only frame of mind you could ever film of something of this nature.
Yeah.
I think you'd have to have no expectations.
And that you allow whatever happens, happens. Because if you're trying to force something, too, you get in the way. Mm. And so, it was a trusting thing. And it turned out nice.
It was a leap of faith to begin filming, but perhaps not that extraordinary given Leonard's past. He was in Italy in the 1960s when a chance meeting with the American actor Brett Halsey led to roles in the burgeoning spaghetti western scene. Later, he tried Hollywood and appeared in Charlie's Angels and a couple of thrillers, but he said the magic had gone and he decided to switch careers and train as a therapist. His decision to film Adrian drew him back to his past, and he says it taught him a lot.
I did, you know, I had I was so fortunate. 21, I got to Italy, and I had a film career there. I starred in 30 movies, and I had spaghetti westerns and cop movies and love stories, and I got to work with some of the greatest, some of the worst. And so I don't need my name on another movie, in fact, I'm not even going to try to sell this film. I'm going to use this film exclusively for trying to raise money for the homeless. We're trying to capture that spirit of the person, that something, that beautiful part of someone. And so I just kept going, and we lost him once. He disappeared,
You literally couldn't find him.
His mom was ringing
you.
Wouldn't answer his phone, wouldn't answer, you know. And I finally got in contact with him. He called me, and I thought, you know, he showed up again. And I thought, oh, God, what am I going to do? I'll take the camera. That was on 4th of July, a holiday. I'm laying in bed. Oh, I should go. I don't want to go. Oh, no, I don't want to get your butt up and go. And I just put the camera on. What do you think about And all this stuff came out. So it was just, it was strange how it happened.
Because in a way, I suppose making that kind of film, you can't have demarcation about your own time, can you? Because in a way, it's Adrian's life is fluid.
And I realized that the relationship between the subject and the... he opened up for me because we had built this that year that I'd followed him and talked to him and cared. He knew I cared.
And for Adrian too, the experience of making the movie has led to big changes. He finally found somewhere to live, access to a clean space and running hot water.
I've been now off the street since February. Oh, yeah, I moved in on Valentine's Day.
Did you?
Last year. Yeah, best girlfriend I ever got. I love the part where I go take my bath and I go run my bath water, get my bubble bath stuff going, put on my music, get my cigarette and smoke it.
That's right.
And not this kind either.
I think the empowering thing was really that I cared, that people were caring about him enough to want to know his story. I mean, I realized, and this is what, you know, the beginning, everyone has a story if we care to listen. And the fact that I really cared about him, I think, was such an empowering thing for him. And that, why should I care about him? He wasn't even caring about himself. And so suddenly he started to discover something. And I think that was a really big part of it. And the housing thing, that just happened. It'd be just really out of nowhere, because he'd been trying and trying and trying, and just, my gosh, it happened like that.
The movie's been showing at festivals in America and the UK, but there are no immediate plans for wider distribution, and Leonard's giving the money raised to charity. In San Luis Obispo, it's still showing to packed audiences.
Thank you, guys.
So are you still shoe shining?
Oh, yeah. I was just there yesterday.
Where? Where are you going?
I'm on the corner of Higuera and Garden. Right.
Oh,
next
wonderful.
Thank you, guys.
May I take your photograph before I have to go?
You want to take it in here? Because I'm going out.
Okay.
It'd be better.
This is what's nice, that the reaction of this film, so many people, is you've changed my way of looking at the homeless. Because I really didn't want to preach. I didn't want to beat anybody over the head. I just want you to check this guy out, and then you take what you're going to take from the film. Yeah, but the reactions have been, I couldn't have asked for more.
Do you think it's changed his life much, having the film made about him?
It has. It has, because people, they respect. You know, he's just not a guy shining shoes. He has a story. You know, he has a life. He's a real person.
It was very touching to me. And, you know, I've worked with kids in the foster system and with families that have lost custody of their kids. And I just know, I mean, I can feel the depth of his intention. But he didn't have the resources, you know, to take a child, and it tears my heart. Everyone has a story, you know?
What was it like for you when everyone started clapping at the end of it?
Well, I could hear the crowd, you know, when they said, oh, or yay, or, you know, and I could see that they actually liked it, you know, so it was fun. It was different.
Do you feel he captured your life? Do you feel
I think he did, because I've had so many people that said they like it. I can't believe it. All the time.
I may be back tomorrow in a set of Oxblood shoes.
Different pair of shoes.
Thank you.
These people here, I love this place. I ain't going no damn way. Thank you very much, sir.
You have a good one.
That was a nice tip.
You came at a good time, too.
Yeah.
Right when I was actually doing something.
Doing your job.
Doing my job.
Yeah.
And you're sort of, do you think you're earning good money now on the street here? Because you've got somewhere to live at long last.
Well, not yet, not as much as I would like to, but since I've moved to Atascadero, something new that I'm going to be doing is oil and clean saddles now.
Oh, right.
And okay. That's no less than 100. Don't even talk to me. And it might cost more. But in other words, if you don't have $100, I ain't even going to look at the saddle. We can't even talk about it or discuss it. So
that's a little offshoot you've got going now,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a movie.
Yeah.
You've gone from shoes to saddles.
And then I could just do both, you know, because I'll still do the shoes too, but I mean, that's just an add-on.
What's going to be the next project then?
You know, they asked me that at the screening, so I told them that if you know somebody who has $1.5 million that they want to throw away, I have an incredible screenplay that I want to do about a play. I produced a play in Los Angeles about 10 years ago called Cages, about men in prison that I did psychotherapy groups with. And they were all in these cages the size of phone booths. And I would do these psychotherapy groups. And they were in administrative segregation, the whole. And it was a quite successful play. And I would do that as a film. But otherwise, I'm not interested in, I'm not.
Well, hopefully it'll do some good.
Yeah, because when it gets to the audience, this is interesting because, I've submitted this to a lot of big festivals. And I realized, and talking to my friend here, who's a distributor, who owns The Palm, telling me about distribution now, is that there's such a gap between the gatekeepers, which are distributors, the people judging film festivals, and the audience. This film just hits audiences. It really, they just resonate with it. The gatekeepers, they don't get it. It's not what they normally see. And so there's this interesting. So all I'm interested in is getting it to people who appreciate it.
Well, I think it's sort of, even at the most basic level, it takes you into one man's life. And in hearing his life, you kind of hear so many of the problems in the society that it's a sort of good lesson in.
And it's about this guy who never gives up. I got a friend of mine who's a sound designer who won 2 Oscars. He won one for Mad Max. He did the sound on that. And he just did Dune. He said, I relate to this guy. So he said, I relate to his struggle. So it's about the struggle of a man, of a person struggling to try to make it. We're all struggling trying to make it, right? Trying to get a job, trying to do, This is what I think is the universality of the story, too. It's about this man who's homeless, and we humanize that, but it's also a struggle that we all face, And I think lucked out that really came through.
You've been listening to the documentary In the Studio from the BBC World Service. I'm Sue Mitchell, and if you want to hear more about the series I was making that inspired this programme, you can listen to Intrigue, Million Dollar Lover on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts.